The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Bill manages the risks. John finds 95,000 security managers. Maria ends up in charge of physical and information security response at Cisco. Tom teaspoons his way to the top. Another company pitches trying to get a hit. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
Stephen, welcome to The Cyber Show. Tell us about the name of your company and what do you do?
The name of the company is Video Support. And Video Support is a B2B platform where customer inquiries and customer communication between digital teams.
All right. You sound like a CEO pitching. Let's try it again. What do you do? What does the company do in simple terms?
Video support and replaces texting between digital teams and users with video.
So it's for sales and support, right?
Right now we focus on sales and support, exactly. This is the version one we have developed. It's working great. And we have found that some of our existing users use it for completely different things, which is very interesting. So we are making
like
video.
What?
For example, a big real estate company, Hello Landing in the US, they use it to show their potential tenants apartments. And they use it in all their communication, if it's like WhatsApp or email, any communication channel. So when you record a video, the video is recorded on a unique URL.
Everybody has unique URLs that they can use for recorded videos, right? We got Vimeo, we got your YouTube. On my website, we have the recordings for the show, right? You can just put a video on the show. So what's the difference between my recording and putting it on my website and putting a link into my email and what you're doing?
This process is very convenient and easy. So let's give you an example. So let's say you are selling this one, refrigerators. Right now, the product is built for physical products and physical environments. So the current clients we have, they just send out a link in an email or by chat or in WhatsApp or SMS. And I'm a user. I click on the link and instantly the video, the iPhone starts recording. You don't need any application, no installments.
You're talking about the production side, right? So
exactly.
One of the big problems with production right now is just what you identified, right? Big problem. If I want to record something, so I have to come into my computer here, or I go on my whatever my thing is, and I push a bunch of buttons, and then I do a recording. And then once I do the recording, then I have to save it, and I got to push it up to somewhere in the cloud, and then I got to find the URL and figure it out and attach it to an email. And you've eliminated all that. You just push a button that says go, and it records it, and it puts it up on a URL. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice feature. Then what happens?
Then what happens? I get notified or you get notified. Depends on the settings in your account. And the video gets reviewed instead of your 15-minute text explaining everything over text. And, well, you want some visualization. What is broken, or you want to show me something, this is all getting replaced by video. And within the company's account, all those videos obviously get saved, organized. They can review it back in a later stage if they want. We are adding features now that they can use those videos in their customer service portals if they have consent from the users. So we developed one simple feature to test the market, which is this feature. We have around 30,000 recordings right now. They're saying, hey, please record your issue. They click on it, and without any installments, starts recording.
They send a link to a customer, and the customer says, look, my bicycle chain isn't working, and they point the camera, then they show how it's not working,
exactly.
And And then they give it back, and then the agent says, aha, and they come over and they do the same thing to their bicycle change. They fix it. They show you how to fix it, right? Yeah. And then it goes back to the other guy who says, oh, I see. Let me try it. He fixes it. Mm-hmm. Oh, it worked.
Exactly. For those kind of things, sound is important and visualization of their problem. Sometimes buyers don't even know how to explain what their issue is, but with video, it's so important.
This sounds like a really great idea, right? Yeah. Before it was a, so we can do recordings, but now you're talking about the service person talking to the customer, showing each other what's going on in real time using their video cameras.
Exactly.
And showing the fix. Okay. And once you've done that, because bicycle chains come off fairly often and lots of people don't know how to put them back on, we have that recorded. So now the agent sitting there doing the service call says, oh, Eric, look at this video. Oh, that's how you do it. Thank you. Goodbye. We're good.
Exactly. And if they need a custom reply from support agent to user or client, they also can reply on the video with the video. So it's video engagement also for the satisfaction, but definitely for the resolution time of the ticket resolvements.
But I like this a lot more, the more you talk. Let me give you a suggestion.
Yeah.
When you try and set up Google accounts, I set up Google accounts for different companies and try and manage all those accounts. It's unfathomably painful to try and work through there. You search for help, and then you get a little bit of help, and you click on this button, and then you're looking at this place, and it opens another window. Now you have to go back to the window. All this stuff could be completely eliminated by somebody simply saying, here's how it works. Now, there are lots of people out on the internet doing these little microservice videos already on their explainer videos is what they're called. Is there a chance that you can go into that market and, for example, take those explainer videos and integrate those?
This is also shown in our pitch deck. We have video support 1.0, the first version. We are raising funds for our second version. And in this version, we do screen recordings. So for the problem you just explained, screen recordings and screen share, like you do right now with Google Meet as well, but then implement it in any CRM system or communication channel like email or WhatsApp. And those videos are getting recorded, and the AI we are implementing will suggest articles from their FAQ based on what they have to say during their recording.
Probably millions of explainer videos out there already. Is there any sense that you're going to let people upload those explainer videos onto the platform and turn it into sort of, you know, instead of the YouTube, into the explainer video platform?
Great idea, for sure. I just mentioned it in the beginning of our call. Users will give their consent to let companies use the videos from their problems and the reply from support to create those videos and have them listed on the unique URL and in the company portal, and they can publish those videos. So many questions come in like on daily basis, and this is easy to solve by showing them the resolution by video requested by another user. So the answer is yes, for sure.
Excellent. All right. Fantastic. So Stephen of videosupport.io, thank you so much. And I think it's a great idea. We need to talk more about this.
Matlack on the 0-1. Bobby hits a drive into the gap in the left center field. There she is. Papers flying, everybody standing.
For more details on this pitch and to view their gee whiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on the Cyber Show. The 4th of July delayed our usual monthly events. As a result, our live online remote free advisory session will be right after today's show. To join us, go to thecybershow.co right now and sign up. News doesn't get much fresher than that here on The Cyber Show. We're discussing the history of the cyber world with Bill Murray. This is not the Bill Murray, the actor. This is William H. Murray, the well-known, globally respected cybersecurity person who has been working in this field for many, many years.
One of the things that the banks are complaining about these days are what they call authorized transactions. These are transactions that are authorized by the victim himself. He's not being duped into surrendering his credentials and having them fraudulently reused by somebody else. It's not account takeover. It's I can get on the telephone and I convince you to use Zelle to send me money. Now, it turns out that that is a problem limited by the size of the transaction. 99% of all the transactions done on Zelle are under $100. So I could set a threshold that says I want to put in special control. I don't want instantaneous transfer for transactions over $1,000. In those, I want to slow things down and give a chance to the user to understand that he just did something stupid.
Right. Most banks do that. In fact,
that's my
My bank certainly has those controls, and I insist upon them, right? Because I'm not doing transactions over certain thresholds without that. And they also notify me of every such transaction, so I know when it happened.
Ah, yes. And I
carefully.
Another thing that I promote actively is what I call out-of-band confirmations.
Yeah, the submit commit cycle. Yeah. So for high-value transactions, you should have that special device where you have to push the button and it's in your pocket. It makes it harder, not impossible, right? So part of the thing is the threat approach, right? So if I want to get you and I'm willing to commit some level of crime to do it, then I'm going to get you. There's really no way out of it.
I always go back to the brown bag session that you and I did at NPS, in which I was trying to tell my audience how to protect themselves, and you were telling them how you would defeat all the things that I recommended. And the problem that I had was that you were treating the cost of attack as though it was zero.
And I think you're completely right, right? It's about driving up the cost of attack.
Right, to exceed the value of success.
Well, that's okay for certain kinds of transactions. The problem is that there are almost never is it the case that I can't find a way to attack you that isn't worth it if the transaction's high enough value. When you get up to $50 million or $100 million, there is no mechanism in common use today that's sufficient to protect you against somebody that's willing to spend $10, $20 million to get that 50.
I've got to drive up the cost of attack so that it exceeds the value of success.
But today, that's not the case for high-value transactions.
Right. Yes, it can be. Look at what's happening to us in ransomware. Okay,
The bad guys are winning.
Ransomware attack is a fraction of the value of success, and I say in order to resist ransomware, we need to raise the cost of attack by roughly one decimal order of magnitude.
Yeah, and so I largely agree with you, but this also goes to prosecution of small crimes to prevent the escalation into bigger criminals, right? So there's an amount of resource that we have to respond, and that's a finite resource. And if we don't stop people and deter them by catching them earlier and causing them to fear doing it and stop them from that set of activities that leads to their being high quality at it, then we're just going to get lots of high quality threats. But the other thing that happens is at the level of nation states, you know, this is an unlimited game. There's no amount of money you can spend that will defend against every possible thing they can do. And if they're willing to put the resources, they'll find some leverage that wins. My big picture of this was that the deception defense seems to be the biggest lever we have. Effective deception dramatically changes the leverage between defender and attacker.
And that's all I'm asking for.
How do we know we're being successful at the Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. One, we know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. Two, we know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. Three, we know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. Four, we know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And five, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show. Only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. Frauds, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. One of the newest frauds on the internet today is a multi-step process. It starts with an initial contact offering something you want or need for your job. Then as you start to communicate, you get a link or a file emailed to you, chatted to you, texted to you, or connected to you through a social media application. When you open this file or click on the link, it displays a message indicating that it was corrupted and could not be opened. But in reality, it contains malicious code that merely displays that message and leaves a Trojan horse on your computer. Once that Trojan horse is in place, the attacker is in your system and expands their access to perform any of a number of malicious acts, typically ranging from extortion, this is often in the form of ransomware, to financial theft, for example, by altering banking information on an invoice. What can you do about it? Well, there's nothing much you can really do to prevent this sort of deception from working. The reason is that if you don't use the internet to get in touch with people in order to get your job done, you're likely not to be able to get the job done. But when you encounter the situation, you can recognize this scenario. And if you do, you can immediately contact whoever's in charge of cybersecurity and have them fix the problem before it gets worse. In the meanwhile, try and be safe out there, but don't imagine you're going to be perfect against modern threats. One of the newest frauds on the internet today is a multi-step process. It starts with an initial contact offering something you want or need for your job. Then as you start to communicate, you get a link or a file emailed to you, chatted to you, texted to you, or connected to you through a social media application. When you open this file or click on the link, it displays a message indicating that it was corrupted and could not be opened. But in reality, it contains malicious code that merely displays that message and leaves a Trojan horse on your computer. Once that Trojan horse is in place, the attacker is in your system and expands their access to perform any of a number of malicious acts, typically ranging from extortion, this is often in the form of ransomware, to financial theft, for example, by altering banking information on an invoice. What can you do about it? Well, there's nothing much you can really do to prevent this sort of deception from working. The reason is that if you don't use the internet to get in touch with people in order to get your job done, you're likely not to be able to get the job done. But when you encounter the situation, you can recognize this scenario. And if you do, you can immediately contact whoever's in charge of cybersecurity and have them fix the problem before it gets worse. In the meanwhile, try and be safe out there, but don't imagine you're going to be perfect against modern threats. The cyber world touches deeply on and closely aligns with progress in the intelligence and counterintelligence fields. Nowhere is that more clear than in the discussions with John Tippett, who helps to put the cyber world in the context of national security.
Now, the next one was in 94, which was a joint security commission. One of the things that happened was during my career, the management of the national security enterprise that oversaw national security processes changed like two or three times. And during the Reagan administration, the Joint Security Commission was actually in charge of national security architecture, and they reported to the National Security Council. So this was the Joint Security Commission redefining security as it supported the national security program. And again, here, I was brought in to testify. I actually became what was called a trusted agent in this one, which meant they sent the draft work to me, and I commented on it before the final draft was completed.
Did they make changes based on your comments or not?
I would say it was probably 50%. I'd have to look it up here, but I think I made like a dozen recommendations, and a couple of them, to be fair, were observations. And to do something about those things I observed meant that other things had to change, because you couldn't do that recommendation and leave this the way it is, because right, it'd be a conflict, right? So there was, I got a lot of attaboys for the work that I did in all these commissions, as a matter of fact. And so some from a higher sources than others. But again, those last two that we talked about were focused on the operations of security. And I'm talking about all the disciplines of security.
Yeah.
And remember, one of the projects that I did through PERSEREC,
Personnel Security
Research Center.
There you go. Which was in Monterey.
In Monterey, right. And during the Joint Security Commission's oversight of the national programs, they commissioned us. In fact, I wrote a proposal for this. They commissioned us to do a study on defining security within the federal enterprise. And so we set about, we worked with the Office of Personnel Management, who is the HR department for the U.S. government, right? So they're the ones that set up the job categories. And to talk about that just a second relative to cybersecurity or computer security, we're the one who made the recommendation that technical folks who worked in computer security should have a separate MOS than security managers.
What is MOS?
it's the designation of your job competency in an area. Like if you're, you know, and it's called different things in different services. MOS is an Army one. That's the only reason I remember it. But it's a category. Now, OPM is the manager of all of those things. And all of security, when we first started this study, all of security, no matter what you did in security, you could be a security manager in charge of a $1 billion program, or you could be a security rep doing ComSec work. You were all in the same job category. And so what that did was truncate motivation for expansion and growth. Security was considered at that time an administrative burden. So when we did that study, what I did, or what my team did, is we collected every national security issuance that spoke to those issues from the National Security Council, executive orders, laws, agency issuances, and we pulled all of that together. And
include presidential orders?
Yes, including presidential orders.
They're classified as well as unclassified.
Yeah, we spent at least a week and a half at the old White House going through records, and they had people there pulling stuff and giving them to us to look at. We really had two products out of that study. The first one was a dictionary, a security dictionary. And what that was a compendium of all of the definitions related to security that were contained in that body of knowledge.
Yeah, were there inconsistencies in those definitions?
Oh, yeah. Some of them were just laughable. I mean, they were just laughable. But we did no editing. We didn't correct spelling. We didn't do anything. We cited the issuance that it came out of.
And you made a copy, right? So you said, here's what these people say. Yeah. So this is a fundamental problem in security, right? That is, definitions aren't even precise or common.
Well, it's hard to have a discussion about a profession if you don't have a common language.
Right. That's one of the big problems we still have.
Oh, sure. And probably will for the future. The primary product, though, was what existed in current doctrine as to security positions and so forth and so on. One of the principal findings that actually kind of surprised me, we found 95,000, I don't think I'll ever forget that number, security managers, called security managers, within the federal government. 95,000.
95,000 people with that title.
With that title that ranged in status from an SES, an SES 3.
Yeah, Security Executive Service 3. That's like near the top. That's a two layers.
The SES Senior Executive Service.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the GS ratings are the civilian ratings. Now, remember, this didn't include the military.
This is just
civilian employees of the government that had that title. And we said, you know, one of the observation was, this is probably ridiculous.
You think?
and so everyone up until probably the late 60s, there was an event in the late 60s, early 70s, that actually changed the security world in this country.
And we'll have to wait till next time to hear what that event was, of course.
Right. But, you know,
95,000 people. That's just civilian, not military.
Like anybody a couple decades into a career, you know, you hear something like that, and I'm picturing where I was at the time and the assumptions I made. Right. Obviously, the U.S. federal government is on top of this, you know, and, you know, with the grid, you know, for the last decade or so, it's like, you know, I talk about this inside the industry, but I would literally hear it, you know, out in the world with friends. It's like, well, obviously, the grid is all secure for the site because that's really important. It's like, you don't understand. We're just making this up as we go along, which is OK. But no, there's no big plan. Right? This is, we're working on it.
95,000 federal workers, not including the military, that had responsibility over managing security-related information, right? That's 95,000. And they don't have common words.
Right.
So what the words even mean is not clear. What the rules are is not clear.
Oh, so today in SBOM, and it's software bill of material sharing, right? You know, this is an area full of gopher holes. Like so many of these we have to navigate. Because you have to solve this before solving that. And naming what things are called, the taxonomy, like you're saying, you know, even using the same language, right? Identity, you know, who made this software? Well, people say it different ways, and companies buy other companies. So, yeah.
Any profession really starts to prosper only after they have common definitions. And throughout my career, I've been having this challenge of trying to figure out common definitions. One of the big things is in the commercial space of security, people make stuff up, right? So we have phishing and farming and you name it, ing, all to say the same thing, and there are actual words for that. And you heard Bill Murray talk about this in a previous session. He was talking about the notion of naming, instead of naming things after the attack, you should name it after the thing that failed, right?
Yeah, right.
And because then you'd be aware of and so forth. There's another interesting thing John said, and that's the phrase national security architecture.
Right.
Now, this is not an architecture of a building or a system. It is a system. It's the notion of what is national security? What's it composed of? How's it put together? How are decisions made and so forth? This is a huge scope.
Yeah. And this is, again, watching what's going on inside the Beltway on this whole topic through my career. Yeah. You know, around 2000, shortly after 2000, started getting involved with this at different levels. And, you know, everybody knows 9/11, right? We have now a Department of Homeland Security. People start thinking about this. So starting in 2001, you know, you end up with things that we see today. And, you know, CISA, the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency in the Department of Homeland Security, is simply, you know, the current version of the NCIC, the National Cybersecurity Communications Integration Center, and the National Infrastructure Protection Plan, you know, which is maintained by a public-private set of groups you know, across sectors that are defined by all these ongoing conversations, right? And it's, yeah, after big notable cybersecurity events, I've been asked many times by journalists, you know, oh, doesn't this, you know, show how bad things are? It's like, honestly, I say the same thing. It's like, this is about what you expect to see about right now. And as far as nations going America's doing pretty good, right? If you thought it would be better by now, that's also a problem. But no, it wouldn't be better by now. But it's better than most, and it's workable enough. It's going in the right direction, generally speaking.
And it's massive and highly funded, and all sorts of other issues. The part of the problem is the pace of change, right? Because things are changing more quickly than they used to, we have less time to adapt. And it becomes more and more important for us to be careful about how we move in terms of putting high consequences on things. Now, I say that it's happening quickly. You know, in 1992, I think I published Protection and Security on the Information Superhighway. And that book talked about the increasing interdependency and the extent to which the consequences of cyber-related failure were potentially catastrophic. 92, let's see, 02, 12, that's 30 years ago plus. And now the consequences are even bigger, and we haven't gotten as better as we should have gotten from where we were then. But the other side of that is probably another 30 years, we still won't be as good as we should be, and the consequences will be even higher, and yet they don't trigger. And one of the things that I encounter a lot when people talk about this, they have these dire predictions. One of them is about water systems. I had this when I was at Sandia National Laboratories. This might be the reason I'm no longer at Sandia I was no longer there at that time. So they're starting to say, oh, these water systems are vulnerable. All these cyber things can happen. Oh, it's horrible and terrible. And I said, excuse me, water flows downhill. Because, okay, good. You broke into the system and the pump no longer works, but there's a big, you know, reservoir on top of a hill. That's why they put it on top of the hill. Full of water, and the water flows down, and gravity will be there. I mean, if gravity stops working, yes, we're in big trouble, but water is not the problem. The problem is nobody's staying on Earth. So water flows downhill, and son of a gun, the way they treat the water is with big chemical things, bags of chemicals, and we can still treat the water, and it'll still flow down to your house, and you'll still be able to drink, and it'll still be clean enough to get away with it. And the other thing that people seem to forget is that they're human beings. They say, oh, this attack's going to happen and, oh, everybody's going to be unable to do anything. No. You know, somebody will go out and fix it. Okay. Oh, yeah, we have people.
Yes. Oh, yeah, people.
The computer breaks. The people aren't going to break. They're going to walk over and say, oh, that's not working. I think I'll attach this pipe to that pipe and get around that thing in the middle that's blocking it, and now it'll work. It won't be as good as it was before, but it'll still work. And so those kinds of solutions, that's what we did in the run-up to Y2K, right? Part of the planning, I went, you know, NERC, the Natural Energy Regulatory Commission, had these, you know, and FERC, they had these meetings, big meetings talking about Y2K and what to do. And, you know, at Sandia, we had studied this. And you know, I just explained it's pretty simple, right? So at that point in time, essentially every substation had an auto off and on. You know, big handle you can turn from off to auto to on. Auto meant it's remotely controlled and automatically controlled by the grid control system. On means energy coming in goes out. So the plan was Y2K happens, the lights go out, you can't get in touch with anybody in your alignment. Go over to your nearest substation and turn it from auto to on. And if everybody does that, it flows. And, oh, yeah, we won't have all that energy because all these sources are crashed. Yeah, but you know what? The turbines, the water turbines, you know,
they still work. You're
still going to have power. Sorry. Yeah. It's like Y2K is not going to cause water to flow uphill. And it's like
a year ago this month, you know, I went out to San Francisco from Key Largo where I got sailed these two prototype boats. I came back and one of them was sinking by the back. And it was a grand little 12-hour, you know, mission to get everything back on top of the water and sail off again. But telling that story to my son, Damien, and I love his answer, you know, because I think if that went down, it would have been the end, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he didn't miss a beat. And he said, no, he would have figured something out. And, you know, he's right. It would have been 4 days instead of 12 hours and things would have been lost, but whatever. Yeah.
People fix things. And every once in a while, somebody can die from that, but there are 8 billion people on the planet.
Yes. Each of which all of us die sooner or later of something. So it's pretty well a given. Yes.
Right. And each of us can individually adapt to the situation based on what we see in our approach.
Yep.
It's a tremendously resilient system overall, composed of a bunch of unreliable components.
Right. All those dire forecasts, you know, growing up, you know, as the youngest Gen X, oldest boomer, whatever is, oldest Gen X, youngest boomer, whatever it was, you know, hearing all these, you know, again, Paul Ehrlich, the population bomb, 1968, the boomer bookshelf, right? You know, and he's on this talk show. I'm 4 years old, and he's saying, explain this carrying capacity, like an island, you know, can only have so many deer because of the carrying capacity. So the carrying capacity for humans for the Earth was 3.54 billion. It's currently 3.52 billion, and 100 million Americans are nothing can stop it going to starve to death in the 1970s.
He was completely right. What happened was we changed the carrying capacity.
Right. That's right. Right. Yeah. So each of these things, you know, and they become, you're talking misinformation, you know, a lot of it is sort of gestalt always there. Like people believe it's like, well, you know, we're all going to die. There's going to be, you know, this, and it's just inevitable.
We are. We're all going to die.
But it's all if we keep doing, you know, in 30 years,
we're all going to die.
Yeah.
We're all going to die whether we keep doing it or not. We're all going to die, but then we have children.
Right. And they keep doing it too. So, yeah.
And they're going to die and they're going to die. But yeah, that's the point. It's called reproduction.
Kids these days, I have 20 something kids and they're awesome. My kids' generation will be fine. If you find yourself saying kids these days, you're old. It's okay. You know, I'm old. We're old now. It's all right. Kids will be all right.
Well, I got to tell you, you say that now, Chris, but you're still young. You know, kids these days,
right?
Wednesday, July 5th, join our free Angel to Exit advisory session. For more details or to sign up, follow the link on thecybershow.co.
We're talking to Maria, who is one of the early women in the cyber world. She's had an amazing career starting as a programmer, and well, let's see where she goes from there. So you got out of NASA at the end of the 90s.
Yeah.
And did you retire from NASA, or how did that happen?
So a couple of years before I left, my manager, the one that was my manager when we responded to the Morris worm, was she went to work for a small startup known as Cisco Systems. And so she was telling me to leave NASA. You know, well, I should say it. She was encouraging me to come over and work for Cisco.
There you go. You know, by the way, we're not going to edit that foible out. That's
okay.
All right. So you moved over to Cisco.
So I went and worked at Cisco till about 2013. I started out as in the network management team, and I got into in my final years at NASA, I started getting into web development, right? Developing user interfaces. And so I actually got hired into Cisco to do web design, web development. So I actually led a team of web developers, and we would write the GUIs to the network management applications and manage websites and things like that.
So you left Cisco at some point, and then what happened?
So I kind of started a company at around that time, too. It was about 2009. I started a physical security company. You know, also while I was at Cisco, I was placed on a team, which my manager at NASA was one of the head of the team. And so she said, you know, Cross, we need to do this. It was for the protection of Cisco's intellectual property. In other words, bringing together all the engineering systems and actually locking them down. Because at the time, Cisco's IP was just...
being taken by the Chinese, right?
Exactly. So she was tasked, along with a couple other gentlemen, with putting together so-called dream team of people to help Cisco achieve this. And so she reached out to my VP and said, we need her. So I actually got thrown into that and was working with Cisco InfoSec. So I started just getting into the security, getting back into security, right? Because I had left that at NASA and then got back into it in a different capacity at Cisco. And, you know, at the time, cameras were just coming online from analog to IP. And that was also something that we were looking at as the overall security of Cisco premises. So not only were we looking at network security, but we were looking at physical security access control, right? You know, how did they get in there to do this and that?
And the integration of the two, right? So that you could know that somebody was physically in a location because they badged in and therefore that they could not be at the other place where they were using the computer.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and then I met my business partner through an introduction through a friend, and we just started talking. It's just seeing that there was like this opportunity, right, to really do a physical security company.
That was Warren, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Who you right. know?
Tales of Parallel Evolution. So I started working at Cisco running the firewall teams in June of 98, and Maria started in October. And sometime around then, at the end of 98, I was contacted by the district attorney, and someone had shown up at a trade show who was a former Cisco employee who had come with the acquisition of the PIX firewall, and he had a booth, and he had a product, and it looked just like PIX, and the typos in the documentation were the same. So the key question was, you know, he's arguing that everybody shares, you know, IP, and it's all just fine, and I said, well, we make $100 million a year with this right now. So it's probably not fine, right? And you know, so it's just fascinating, you know, to hear Maria talking about this, you know, because at that time, yeah, IP was leaking all over the place. You know, the internal security wasn't great. Great call out to Steve Atchison. I'm sure Maria and Steve worked a lot together. I just saw him at this past RSA, you know, securing the infrastructure of the company that's making the infrastructure that you need to secure. It's a wonderful little redundant cycle, isn't it?
Right. When you start to listen to her through her career, you know, she's doing other things. It's like she gets out of security. What is it from the Godfather part, something two or three? Whenever I think I'm out, they pull me back in.
Right.
So that's Maria, you know. And so now she's doing the physical as well as the logical, as well as the intellectual property. And she's one of a small team at Cisco. Now they call it the dream team. You know, I guess they were dreaming about trying to have security in a big enterprise like that against the nation state. And when you were at Cisco, you were selling the security hardware, you know, the routers and switches, as opposed to trying to secure them, right?
Well, so I had the PIX. I was actually hired to run the what was it called, Sentry firewall that got end of life immediately. This Windows NT firewall, and then there was the PIX, which was the appliance, which I was given mostly because it was a train wreck. It was almost immediately end of life, and we black ops, you know, did a crazy under the cover operation and got it stabilized and turned that into a, you know, it's about $3 billion. You know, that team can claim in sales, but the iOS firewall, the software firewall for the Cisco code, you know, also fell into that domain. So we had that joint team for some number of years. Yeah. So writing right through that same era from 98 into the early 2000s, when Cisco as a company, you know, building the infrastructure for the internet globally, has to get their own house in order and provide security offerings, you know, and secure their own infrastructure. So it's,
yeah. But you didn't know Maria at that time. You know, you were working, it's a big company, but it wasn't that big when you started. But, you know, the notion that your paths cross, right?
Right.
Again and again.
I would imagine she was probably on some of the PCERT calls. Name looks really familiar. I'll probably feel really bad when we reconnect, you know. But yeah, it was hectic times, like the product security incident response team, right? You know, remember the PIX firewall had a big vulnerability, and it was real, right? And there was an individual researcher out in the world had found it, had contacted us. I'd gotten directly in contact with him. We made a deal. Give us 10 days, you know, to get a fix out there before you announce it. And he announced it the next day. Right.
Of course.
Calamitous. You know, I've never said that individual's name out loud. They don't deserve the credit. And I don't know anybody that even knows the name. So perfect. But yeah, you know, it's a bunch of people on email all of a sudden at 3 o'clock in the morning. Maria was probably one of them, you know, given her background. You know, how do we fix this? Let's figure it out.
Yeah, and that's another whole interesting set of issues, right? The let's make a deal. You know, how about if you hold off the disclosure? You can get all the credit in the world, and we'll thank you for it publicly.
Right.
But no.
But you go back on that. I will never speak your name. No one will know who you are. And
which is a really interesting perspective, right? So this goes back to a Woody Allen movie, Sleeper. And, you know, remember, he wakes up from the sleep and they bring him out and the historians are asking him to talk about history. And they show him pictures of various things. And his interpretation, he sees Richard Nixon and he says, I have no idea who that was. I don't know. Some guy. I don't know. Nobody knew him. You know, that's, you know, a really interesting perspective on history, right? And instead of talking about, you know, people you think are bad guys as bad guys, you just say, well, they didn't exist. So they will be forgotten instead of, you know, hated.
These things have grown to the, you know, to put things in the current context, you know, now we have the Department of Homeland Security that didn't exist then. And inside that, we have the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA, which didn't exist even more recently. And inside that, we have multiple public-private work streams working on supply chain security. And inside that, you know, we have a very active topic of how we have the human communications, you know, the collaboration between all the different stakeholders and so forth, and manage things in a way that has much more to do with whether, you know, with that issue back in 1999, you know, with whether or not I will say this person's name. Right. We're not cryptographically fixing this. You know, there's a great deal about information security and cybersecurity and business operations that is purely human. You know, they're handled by non-technical means.
Well, and of course, the reality is, you know, as much as I understand and know about and work on and do stuff related to cybersecurity, the vast majority of the changes that need to be made are governance changes in organizations. And we talk about this all the time. One of the problems is you go to these organizations and say, we want to help you. And they say, we need help. But the help that they ask for is almost always not what they really need. And they probably can't get the funding from governance to change governance, right? It's sort of like saying, you know, hey, boss, can I change your job? To which the boss says no. And that's the end of that. So you're like, you know, your job is to make sure that the bad bits don't happen. You know, right. I think that's their view of it, right? Your job is to make sure we don't have any of the bad bits. We only have the good bits.
Right. And this is why policy hacking is the only thing that interests me anymore. You know, it's the technology is wonderful. We'll come up with or alter any technology to fit the purpose. But what's the environment? What are people doing with it? What are the rules? Why are the rules there? Who makes the rules?
Well, but so that's where I'm going to be at odds with you yet again. That's going to happen.
Good.
Because of the influence operations, policy hacking is increasingly a technical aspect of things. And because of things like the automation of generative AI, we now have the ability to create new sorts of tools that do the influence operations that implement that policy hacking. So that policy hacking now has a very strong technical component to it.
Well, in 1860, you know, the Crimean War at the time started because of a technical difference between communications being hacked, you know, ones that had this program and didn't. I'm not implying that there was any, you know, particularly nefarious hacking involved with that. However, you know, the technical means have always been part of the toolkit of policy hacking.
Yeah,
but you're right. We're in unique.
Just for clarity. As you were talking about the technical communications problems, we had technical communications problems with you, and part of that was zapped out, which I think is the perfect thing on the Cyber Show. We're not going to try and fix it. We're going to go on to the next segment.
Tuesday, July 18th, go to Angel. Present your company, get on the show, and make a fortune. Or not. For more details or to sign up, follow the link on thecybershow.co.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
We're going to be talking with Tom Johnson about the cyber education world and how he got into it and his involvement, largely surrounding digital forensics and law enforcement and bringing forward cybersecurity into the world in large numbers.
Now, the other thing is, let's go back to Webster, okay? Because Webster was very interesting because this was the time when I really depended upon you to come in and you were able to form and became director of our computer laboratory. And that was so important. And just your presence and help in that area was so incredible. And basically, while at Webster, I took the program to several different Army posts. I forget the names of them all offhand, but it really was very useful. And then after the Webster thing, that's when you helped me start the Cyberspace Strategies and Solutions.
Let's stick for a minute with Webster. So at Webster, my recollection is we got up to several hundred master's degree students per year, right?
Right, right.
Do you know what the number was there?
Not offhand, no, but it was big.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any program in the world that got up over 200, 250 master's students per year being produced in cybersecurity. And I think that might have been the largest program in the world.
Well, I don't know, but I know that it wasn't at just the St. Louis campus in Webster. It was because I started all these programs on our military bases and in our the other campus sites, because we had so many campuses that we were responsible for. For example, when I was dean there, I had 10,000 students in the School of Business, and they weren't all in St. Louis. They were on our multiple campus sites. And so one of the things that I did was move a lot of computer security programs, because people were asking for it. People wanted it. And we were offering it, but I had the good fortune of having people such as yourself and John Tippett and Bill Sperno and others that I would reach out to, and I would basically say, look, can you help me with this? And you would say, oh, yeah, we can do much more than what you've got. And so then you would basically suggest other people to join us in that. And so the whole thing was that I was in a very fortunate spot to basically have so many wonderful friends that believed in computer security, cybercrime, and national security. And they wanted those things to exist, and they wanted them to succeed. And we were doing that stuff before most universities were thinking of doing it. So in any event, thanks to you,
let's get serious. Thanks to you, right? I was one of 20 or 30 people that were doing different aspects of this for you, and you had fantastic people. You had people doing education in intelligence operations that are former CIA intelligence operations people, right?
So, right.
You know, and the same across the board. One of the really fascinating things that you did at universities,
Fred,
Tom.
Fred, I got to tell you this before I forget it. Excuse me for interrupting here. But I went to the, what's the group that's that does national laboratory research? You know, they're concerned about what's happening over in Ukraine by the Russians taking that thing. But I had three of their people join us. Two of them were just absolutely phenomenal. And they go out to different national security labs, and they evaluate them to make sure that there's no problem with the laboratory. So
the thing I wanted to point out is one of the things that you did better than anybody I'm aware of was, and this was because you managed to get into that position in the university. You were moving mountains, a teaspoon at a time, right? That's how I used to describe it. But one of the things you were able to do was to get practicing professionals with the proper degrees, so they had the necessary sort of certificates or whatever, PhDs, to be able to teach in universities. And you brought the practical experts doing this for real into universities, educated the students in that, and then had a path for those students to talk to those experts who are actually doing it day to day and learn from them. And that's something that's so different from what other universities have done. It's just astonishingly effective. And the people that I still see from those programs that are out there in the world doing this, they come back and they tell me, you know, these programs were invaluable. The stuff that our professors told us was the real stuff.
You know? That's right. That's right. Yeah.
So that's something very few people have succeeded in doing.
Well, I think you're right on that. We had a lot of opportunity to meet top-level people and let them work with us and stuff like that.
Well, what you did was you engaged with them in a way that was, I don't know what the right way to say it was. You never made anybody do anything, but I think they all wanted to work with you.
Yeah, I think you're right. They were wonderful people, and basically if you give them an opportunity and you ask them to develop some courses, they get engaged and involved. And so I was very blessed by the people that I've worked with and met. You know, they're the ones that should get all the credit. For example.
Yeah, but there are lots of people out there, you know, that try, but some people succeed, and you're one of them.
Which is a perfect segue to what I've been thinking about with Tom, right? You know, the classic cliche that, you know, the average, you know, rich entrepreneur has failed 8 times and keeps trying over and over again. You know, that's true, not just about making money, right? You know, Tom has done a lot of things, you know, the Cyberspace Research Institute, right? You know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, whenever I joined Unisys and we had that beautiful facility in St. Louis, we're going to build a big lab there. Situations changed and we didn't get done, right? So for all the things that Tom has done, it's this constant, relentless optimism, effort, attempt, you know, keep doing things, keep moving forward. It makes a difference.
All of the above. So, you know, the thing about Tom is he had an unbelievable, still does have an unbelievable amount of energy, right? So he would come over to my house and we'd be, you know, working on some curriculum or you know, some proposal or whatever we'd be working on. He'd come over to my house and, you know, he's always still welcome at my house, but he would come over and we would sit there and I'd be getting to the point of exhaustion. You know, and Tom's, you know, 15, 20 years older than me, right? So I was still young by comparison. And, you know, I've been working on this thing for 12 hours. He says, okay, you know, there's only 8 more things to do. Let's just keep going. You know, it just doesn't matter what time. Let's just keep going. And we would just keep going and going. And he would, you know, pull out so much good stuff and get it done. And not only that, he would get it done now. Right.
Yeah.
And I always felt wonderful every time I did anything with or for Tom. Just very nice and generous and giving and friendly. And you notice how little credit he takes.
Right. Right.
It's like
right, yeah. Around all the times, so even the hallmarks, and you know, there are cliches out there and many of them are true. And this is one, you know, I'm responsible for the failure of my team. You know, everybody did great work, you know, and I'm sorry I wasn't able to bring it. You know, my team was amazing. We won, you know, all the work done by everybody else. This is how you talk about it. And it's how you think about it. It's not a trick, right? You know, you actually have to, you know, realize that it's not about you. You know, and at the same time, look, Tom's a great guy. You know, I worry a little bit about people who are too humble because, like, you have to realize your strengths. And Tom does. I think he rides that line really, really well. But no, he's not out promoting himself. He's just getting things done.
And so many things done. And the other thing is, if you listening back to the previous shows, the various places he's worked, the various people he's worked with, as you do this over the course of your career, you build up a set of people you're dealing with that are just an incredible set of people, right? So I'm sure that when he was working, I don't know, but I'm sure that when he was working at the State Department, you know, going around to country after country after country, he probably ran into all sorts of people high up in intelligence and counterintelligence and military and you know, you name it, right? And I'm absolutely sure that he was loved by all. He engaged most of them and they ended up working with him to do something beneficial to the world. Because that's all Tom talks about at the end of the day, is doing good things for the world, helping other people, teaching other people, you know, getting honest, you know, factual information out there. And it's not just that he talks about it. he also does it. So he's written many books, right? So I've written, you know, a couple chapters in books for him, but he's writing book after book after book. And you can't really talk about the success of Tom without talking about Colleen, his wife of many, many years, because, well, among other things, she was the administrative assistant for a lot of the things that he did. She was responsible for doing all the collaboration and coordination over the books, these multiple chapters. She did copy editing. She was heavily involved in all of this stuff day to day. You know, she came out to California when he was in California. You know, he would commute and she would run the programs here. So, you know, there's a team involved. And of course, Colleen is in every way just as wonderful a person as Tom is. So it's just, it's astonishing how much he is able to achieve.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies. Next week on The Cyber Show, Bill starts to use leverage to move the world. John explains why the police may serve, but they don't actually protect. Maria describes how she banged the gangs and how the law stopped her. Tom mentions one more thing, or maybe 20. More fraud, spies, and lies, and another pitch gone wild. Only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time and foul. A good time and foul. A strange beaten man and a fiddler for a band. A good time.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.